afternoon, San Marcos. Good afternoon, Planet Earth. Welcome to another episode, episode 4 of Philosophy and Popular Music. I'm Paul Wilson, your host. And I'm here with my good friend Ace Pepper.
Hey, everybody.
Live and in person. And if technology doesn't fail us, we'll have our good friend Rick Stockton up in Colorado on the phone.
Howdy, guys. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Rick.
I can hear you, Rick. Cool, man. Technology.
Great. Technology.
Yeah.
Well, you've just been listening to the version of I Am the Walrus done by Rick and his wife Helen. They have a band called The Scones. They used to be known as The Strolling Scones. That's off their Two Vegans album. And of course that's a play on the John and Yoko Two Virgins album. And Rick and Helen did an album of all 60s tunes, and what we just listened to was one of the songs, all of which were recorded on analog. And the focus of today's show, this is, we're actually going to get a little more philosophical in this episode than perhaps we have in the earlier ones, but this is a very interesting topic with respect to popular music. It's not only about the change in technology, but it's also about the aesthetics of analog versus digital sound. It's about how that's impacted the business. It's about the physics of sound, the alchemy, the magic of audio engineering. And my good friends Ace and Rick are here because they are not only wonderful musicians, but they've also produced, between the two of them, a number of albums.
We don't know what that number is, but it's a number.
That's right. So So let's see. How should we start this? Maybe Rick. Rick, tell us about the 2-inch analog reel machine that you have. Tell us its history, and let's start there, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. Basically, I was, you know, I used to live in San Marcos. And when I was living there, I was, you know, we were in the analog days at first, and I had a 16-track Scully, which was a real dinosaur, but it sounded wonderful, but it was it had its problems because of its age. Mm-hmm. And so about in the mid-90s, everybody was changing over to digital, and they were getting ADATs and D88s. Is that what they were called, the Tascam?
Yeah, the D88s. I had some of those.
Ace had some.
And there was a studio in Houston that had this wonderful Sony MCI JH24, which is a 2-inch 24-track recorder, 2-inch tape. And they were switching over to D88s, and so I was able to purchase that for the same price it would have cost me to get 24 tracks of D88s. And basically the machine still runs fine, and most of those D88s are obsolete now.
Yeah, they
so,
are.
So it was a good purchase at the time, and it's in. Basically, I just continued recording analog for quite a while, and I still have the machine, and it's still running well, although I'm using Pro Tools a whole lot now, too. So I've had I'm using a combination of the 24-track JH24, the 2-inch machine, and bouncing those tracks down to Pro Tools for the convenience of using Pro Tools, which is a digital format that everybody's using these days, so... That's pretty much it, and the machine is, you know, these old tape machines, as long as you can keep them running, sound wonderful, and they're pretty bulletproof in general. You know, I haven't had near as much trouble with them as I have with the digital equipment.
Interesting. Well, Ace, you know, when I met Ace and I met both you guys in the early 90s when I was a young college student here, and I was trying to, you know, make my name on the music scene, and although I think I had recorded at a couple different studios before recording at Ace's, when I the first time I recorded at Ace's, he still had a reel to reel. So that first mm-hmm. Loblolly stuff we did was on reel, and the second batch of tunes we did was on your D88s.
Exactly.
So Ace and Rick, why don't you tell us about what's the difference in the aesthetic between the analog and the digital? Let's tell our listeners about that.
Well,
quality of the sound, you know.
The quality of the sound is hard to quantify. When you get into high quality analog tape, everybody thinks of analog as being noisy and hissy and stuff. It's really not. When you get into pro quality analog tape, it's just as quiet as anything. The machine I had when you and I met mm-hmm. was a Tascam 80-8. Mm-hmm. It was 8-track, not like 8-track cassettes like you had in your car. There were 8 tracks on a 1/2-inch tape, and it was entry level pro recording and stuff. It ran at 15 inch per second. It used 2-inch tape or 1/2-inch tape, reel to reel tape, and it was great. Like Rick was saying, man, that stuff sounds really good. When you get into the pro level analog stuff, the sound is just terrific, man. It's pristine. It just sounds like what stuff ought to sound like, man. It's a little hard to explain, but when you A/B it with the digital, you can feel it. There's a depth and a warmth to the sound on the analog that is just somewhat missing in the digital stuff.
It sounds more organic, is the idea.
It does. Yeah. Organic is a good word for it, because it doesn't have to get translated and stuff. There's a warmth to it, which is why people still like recording on it. I know it's why Rick likes it, and it's why a lot of big acts like it. What's real popular now is for the acts that the sound quality matters. They like to record stuff on the pro analog tape to get some of that warmth, and then, like Rick does, dump it to Pro Tools for the convenience of the digital editing, which is super convenient and a really, really beautiful thing. We love Pro Tools. It's great. But there's a thing with the analog tape. There's a vibe, a sound, a tone that you get with the analog tape that is just really hard, or in many cases impossible, to reproduce any other way. So even if you record to analog and then dump it to digital, you still get some of that sound that comes with it, and that's what we like about it.
Can you hear me out there?
Yeah.
I was, you know, as Ace was mentioning, the quality, you know, the lower end tape decks are noisy, or they can be noisy. And, you know, you can even listen to a cassette tape. I mean, and it's going at a super slow speed. I mean, it can sound pretty good if you turn it up, but when you turn the music down, you can hear a hiss. And that's because the tape is running at a very slow speed, and it's squished onto this tiny piece of tape. Mm-hmm. But the trick is, with analog tape, is to hit the tape hard so you're getting a really loud signal on it, because there's a noise floor there. And, you know, if you turn up any analog tape loud enough, you're going to hear hiss. But what you got to do is get your levels of the music higher than the hiss, and nobody ever hears the hiss on there.
When you get into the pro quality analog stuff, you're running it at much faster tape speed, and that gets the noise down too. That's why they do that.
Yeah, my deck goes at 15 and 30 inches per second. And so that's most of the time I record at 30, which means you get about 15 minutes of music on a reel of tape, which is gets pretty expensive after a while.
Because
tape has gotten ridiculously expensive, but you can always record over it too. Right. That's the nice thing. It isn't a one-shot deal. but that's one of the things about analog. But also, I think one of the things is you hit the tape, you can hit it pretty hard with a signal, and it sort of compresses it a little bit, and maybe gets a little, some not audible distortion, but some sort of smoothing distortion in there that causes some of that really nice warm sound that you get with the analog tape.
That's exactly right. One of the things that you can do with the analog tape is the recording the levels. With digital world, mm-hmm. when you peek it out, it just goes to crap immediately. With analog tape, you've got this little fudge room. You've got this little space in there where you can hit it a little on the hard side, and it breaks up a little bit, but not going to crap. It just gets a little hairy, but in a good way.
It's doable. It's not
You can get a little artsy with it, man. You can have a little freedom. You can have a little bit of fun with it. And like Rick is saying, it does compress the sound a little bit. It brings out all the quiet stuff. It keeps a lid on the loud stuff. And it gets a little more in-your-face sound, and you get a little creative with that.
Fellas, we've got to do some very brief station identification type stuff. Philosophy in Popular Music is sponsored in part by the Texas State Department of Philosophy, Texas State University Department of Philosophy, and in affiliation with the Philosophy Dialogue Series. Join the conversation. My guests today, we're discussing the aesthetics of digital versus analog sound, the aesthetics and technology of digital versus analog sound, and I've got my good friends Ace Pepper and Rick Stockton. Ace here locally in the studio with
us. Ace Pepper here.
And Rick is all the way over in Peonia, Colorado, and Rick is a San Martian of old. He and his wife Helen moved up to Colorado in the 90s, and we're just discussing the history, the technology, the aesthetics of the analog sound versus the digital. So, Rick, tell us more about where our line of conversation. Where are we going next?
Well, we were talking about both Ace and I were here during the transition from analog to digital.
Yep.
Yes.
And I remember very well how people would come into my studio and say, "Man, I just recorded digital, but I couldn't get a good sound." And, you know, during the early days of digital, people, you know, hadn't figured out how to make it sound as good. It just didn't sound warm. It sounded really, like crispy, and, you know, it just didn't quite have that old sound. And
yeah, there's technically, you can get more clarity on the digital, but it lost a lot of life. It didn't sound as warm or you know, the way you expected it to sound. It just didn't have the tone.
And CDs cost like $100 a piece.
I know. I remember that when you
not quite that bad.
I know.
They used to be stupid.
They were like 20 or close. Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, finally people started figuring out that if you put some tubes between the microphone and the tape or whatever you're recording, you know, the digital signal, it sounded better because the tubes sort of do the same thing, not exactly, but kind of similar thing to what tape does to the sound. It sort of compresses it. It adds a little fuzziness to it, and it sounded better.
Yeah.
And so people started using tube preamps, tube microphones, tube compressors, and all of this old equipment from the 50s and the early 1960s started selling for like astronomical prices because everybody wanted that stuff again, and all of this stuff that was probably in mothballs or thrown away was valuable again. I mean, some of these old tube mics were going for like $10,000 and stuff like that, and you know, people had sold them for nothing, you know, when in the late 60s when everything went transistor.
Well, and we should probably mention a little bit about what audio compression is.
Yeah.
The kids don't know about this stuff. To the kids, compression is like how you compress a file. Like
they've heard compressed audio their whole life on the radio.
Heavily compressed. What we're speaking of about audio compression is a phenomena of keeping a lid on how loud things can get, actually compressing the loudest parts of the sound and taking down the volume and bringing up the quiet parts so that everything becomes... there's not as much difference between the quiet stuff and the loud stuff, so all the quiet stuff becomes up in your face and obvious, and all the loud stuff gets a lid put on it to where it doesn't freak out and stuff. So that's the kind of compression that we're talking about in terms of audio compression. And when used for good and not evil, it's really cool. It brings out the detail and warmth of the sound that you're trying to hear and the character of the instrument. And that's the kind of audio compression that Rick and I lust after. That's the things that turns audio engineers on, is you get the detail and the warmth of the instrument and the human voice and stuff.
Now, years ago, radio is all whenever there's a song broadcast over the radio, and this has always been the case, mm-hmm. but it's become much more so in the past 10, 15 years. But if you're listening to a vinyl record at home, since it's vinyl, since it's not digital, since it's got that warm sound, you'll hear the dynamics of things. Mm-hmm. If you were to hear, you know, if I were a kid in Dallas and I was playing like a Zeppelin album, but if I listened to it on Q102, it would be a bit more compressed.
A whole lot more compressed. Yeah. Radio has always done that. Partially of a phenomenon of radio itself.
Right.
You just have to do that to get the sound to come out over the air the way you expect
right.
to hear it.
But digital has, that's 5-10-fold. The compression phenomenon has become a problem.
Now they
right?
do it to make everything freaking louder.
Yeah.
And it does everything.
Catch your attention. Yeah.
Yeah, and everything becomes all in your face and kind of one level, and everything sounds loud. And that's part of what we miss about music is the difference between the loud and the quiet. That room, that headroom, the breath of the music and stuff. Radio tends to make everything sound loud.
What's
more musical is the difference between the loud and the soft.
Yeah.
Like if you ever listen to classical music on the radio, you think they went off the air because
yeah.
they will let the quiet
yeah.
parts play.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you're like, what is it? Are we still on?
Yeah.
But that's just classical music.
Yeah. But no, that's a great example.
Yeah. Classical is very dynamic and it doesn't work good to compress it. You know, because you lose that dynamic, and when you want the loud part, you want it to really rock you, and you want the soft part to bring you down. You know, and if it's always constantly loud, you miss all of that.
So, now are all of your recordings? I mean, do all the Scones albums or CDs now, are they done on your 2-inch reel, or was the Two Vegans a special project? I mean, are we listening to something that was different, or just a series of analog recordings from your studio?
I think it was one of the first ones I'd mixed to analog in many years.
Okay,
because I inherited a big old MCI analog machine from the local radio station up here because they were getting rid of it.
Oh,
and
wow.
Digital equipment. And before that, I had been mixing down to DAT, which is a digital
right.
format.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, let's mix down to analog and see how that works. And it was nice. And so I hadn't done mixed to analog in a long time, but I had been recording on the 24-track 2-inch machine for years and years.
Yeah.
And now... the last album we did the basic rhythm tracks on the 2-inch machine, and then some of the vocals. Yeah, I think we did the lead vocals on the 2-inch machine, and then we bounced down to Pro Tools and did some of the guitar and some of the other things on Pro Tools, and it worked out really well.
So,
we got that warmth of the rhythm tracks and
okay.
the vocals. But the guitar is not quite so pertinent sometimes, as long as you got the
yeah.
other stuff going on analog.
And your old machine is a 24-inch, correct?
The 24-track.
It's 24-track.
24-track.
Yeah,
24-track. So it's you can record quite a few tracks on it,
right.
as long as you got plenty of preamps, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Ace, when Ace got his D88s, he had an 8-track and then a second 8-track.
Yeah, exactly. They ran in sync, so they acted like one big 16-track
yeah,
machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember thinking that this was a step in the future. At the time, I didn't know, you know, I've got a good ear for harmony. I don't know that I've ever had a great ear for tones and things. I mean, I if something is blaring obvious, but yeah, I would be interested to hear the reel-to-reel recordings from your place right next to the digitals back-to-back and see.
I would too, and I wish I still had some.
Yeah,
of that
we've
stuff.
We've got them on we got them on a disc. We don't have you know. So I don't know that the digital impression is probably pretty pretty much there on both of them, but.
What was real interesting with the DA88s is the ADATs and the DA88s. That was the fastest I've ever seen technology go from state of the art to obsolete.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole method of recording those tape machines were state of the art for about 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and then computing power caught up,
and then Pro Tools
and then
off to the races. Yeah,
and then what happened with computing power is it just kept getting better and better. The DA88s and the ADATs were 16-bit 44.1 digital sample rate, which was CD sample rate, and it was good at the time. Very quickly, computers caught up to that, and then very quickly, computers got better than that with even higher sample rates. Now, with a higher sample rate, think of it as like dots in a picture and stuff. With a higher sample rate, you get more dots, so the picture becomes smoother and clearer, so better fidelity. And so computers very quickly obsoleted even the digital tape machines because the clarity was so much better. The resolution of the sound was so much better. And that's what really obsoleted them. That's really why the D88s are so freaking dinosaur now is because...
Yeah, I know. It's like I have a bunch of ADATs and they're just sitting there collecting dust.
Oh, yeah. But, and there's nothing to be gained by going back to that because the computer stuff, you get the resolution is so much better that why would you go back to that? The only thing that has better resolution than that, ironically, is an analog 24-track machine,
and
which ironically has better resolution than any of the computers, which is why we still love them so much.
I know.
Everything sounds very smooth.
The thing about Pro Tools is the convenience of not having to rewind tape, and you can manipulate things so easily on Pro Tools. So, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to it, but, you know, you do miss a little bit of the sound. You know, a couple projects ago, I recorded, I live in Western Colorado, but we have a friend who has a really amazing studio in Boulder. So we were over there and we were working on a project, and Helen, my wife, recorded some vocals over there on, and he has a nice Pro Tools HD setup with, you know, everything top notch. I mean, this guy's got a huge studio. And so we recorded this lead vocal over there, and then we brought it back to the studio in where we live in Paonia. And we said, well, let's do a vocal. Let's do the vocal on the 24 track and just see how, the analog machine. And we bounced it on back, and we had bounced it back to Pro Tools, the analog version of it, put them next to each other, and you could really hear a difference.
Wow. Yep.
So, I mean, it's true. But, I mean, you don't necessarily hear the difference if you don't A-B them. You know, say, well, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
But when you A-B them, you can hear the difference. I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, on that, let's pick up on that note when we come back from station identification and that sort of stuff here in the next couple minutes. You're listening to Philosophy and Popular Music. I'm your host, Paul Wilson. Philosophy and Popular Music is supported in part by the Texas State University Department of Philosophy in affiliation with the Philosophy Dialogue Series. Join the conversation. And we're back. I'm Paul Wilson. This is Philosophy and Popular Music, Episode 4. And this is a new radio series that KZSM is allowing me to broadcast and perform. I'm bringing in good friends of mine for each show, and we're talking about all kinds of issues in music. And basically the format is kind of arranged or formatted itself, I suppose. But the way these things have been going, we've been focusing on a particular topic. We'll talk for about a half an hour about the history of the particular topic, and then we'll get into as much of the philosophical stuff now. So now we've mainly been talking about history, technology of analog and digital. Is there really any philosophical dispute here? Does analog just, I mean, obviously there are pragmatic advantages to doing digital, like Rick said, the ease of rewinding, but is there really any contest? Does anybody dispute that analog sounds better?
Speaking to the philosophy of the recording, and this I really find interesting, man, the philosophy of recording analog, when you're using a tape machine like that, it's hard. You tend to do complete performances,
okay,
right? You can't just do little bits of sound and stuff. You tend to have to play a song front to back and stuff. And yes, you can punch in and fix the note and stuff, but like with digital, it's really, really easy, disturbingly easy,
yeah,
to just like
fix every little note, every individual note, every individual word to make it freaking perfect, man.
Right.
And you can spend a lot of time with this. With analog, you tend to have to record a whole performance.
Right.
And I think that's a real big philosophical difference,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
It's not as easy to edit, so you have to get it right the first time or the second time. You get do-overs and stuff, but you can't just sing a word and then sing another word and paste them together, man. You have to play the song from front to back. You have to capture a performance.
Right.
Whereas with digital, it's really easy to just piece together a performance. And I think that's a really big philosophical difference, man.
Yeah.
The difference between piecing together a piece of art and then capturing the complete performance of an artist, man. I think that's a real big difference, and it's a real profound difference.
Yeah. What do you think, Rick?
I think, Ace has certainly got a point there. Although, you know, with analog, there are certain things you can do. You can certainly punch in parts, vocals, or a lot of times people would record three lead vocals and then just pick the best part of each vocal and then make one vocal out of it.
Exactly.
And you can bounce stuff down to another track. You know, I mean, that used to be really a popular thing to do when they had limited tracks. Once they got 24 tracks, it simplified things because that's quite a few tracks to work with. You know, back in the Beatles days, you know, we were talking about the Beatles earlier, they were using four track, and they would, you know, what they would do is they'd record, maybe sometimes they would record four tracks on one deck and then bounce those four tracks onto one track on another deck.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose a little quality every time you do that, but it allowed them to get a lot of extra tracks and not have to record everything at the same time.
Well, you also had to make a bunch of mix decisions when you're doing that too, man. Because
you could not reverse. Yeah,
exactly.
You had to know what you were doing if you were going to do that. You had to say, well, if we do this, that's the way it's going
to
be. And
yeah, you have
sure
to commit to a sound.
When you bounce it.
And this is the thing I've noticed this in, I won't name names. I mean, I'll tell him in private and I'll tell people who know him in private. But there are certain producers I know, great musicians, brilliant producers, that because the technology allows for all this stuff you can do, you know, whereas digital, we can do things more efficiently, but now there are all these choices. So you can spend, you know, you can get lost in the minutia of ways to compress or ways to, you know.
Or even ways to capture a source.
Yeah.
I was doing a session not too long ago at the Fire Station recording studio, recording to a Pro Tool system digitally with unlimited tracks, and that's a biggie. Mm-hmm. Man, it's no longer just 24 tracks. It's now unlimited tracks. So, like, for instance, where we just put a mic on a guitar amp before, now it's put a half a dozen different mics on a guitar amp and record all of them and capture every possible source of sound and make the decision later as to which one you like, but capture as much from as many different sources as you can. Because track count doesn't matter, man.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it makes you more creative because there's all the stuff you can do. On the other hand, it makes you a little bit lazy because you just capture a bunch of stuff and you spend hours messing with it later after the fact.
It seems like the possibilities of digital lend themselves to people obsessing more over things because you have too many options.
Yeah, option overload, man. When we did 24 tracks, you would never record four tracks, four different mics on one guitar amp. That was just silly. That was wasting tracks, man, that you needed for other parts and stuff. Now, hell yeah, they do that all the time, man. They put, you know, 20 mics on a set of drums because track count is cheap.
Well, you know, I have a background in video production, and the problem with the way it used to be is like you had to have a script because video and film was just too expensive to go out there and waste it. And then when digital came along, reality television exploded about the same time, and they will shoot hundreds of hours to get a 1 hour show.
Yes.
And you know, it's like that's not any more efficient because now you're doing all the work on the back end.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so that's what that reminded me of, eight microphones on one guitar take.
Yeah.
It's like someone's going to have to make that decision somewhere down the line.
Right.
It would be better if you made it up front, a guy who knows microphones.
So,
yeah.
So what's the moral of the story here? We've gone further technologically, but we're not. I don't know. It's an odd thing to ponder.
And even weirder with more modern pop music, you've got whole genres of music that are not even performed at all. They're just pieced together with little Lego blocks of sound.
Exactly.
That you just piece together, and that's a big philosophical difference, man. Mm-hmm. Piecing together music out of little pieces of noise that you didn't even create, man. You just find these little blick. On the one hand, it's creative because you can put stuff together. On the other hand, it's kind of cheating because you don't have to create yourself. You can just grab stuff and put it together, and the software will make it play in sync and make it play in the same key and make it sound musical without any thought or talent or anything on the part of the person.
This is, and that's a related topic for sure. How the digital revolution has allowed for non-artists, non-musicians to be able to make stuff.
Exactly. For every Taylor Swift they put on the cover and stuff, Taylor Swift just comes in and cuts a vocal track. There's some geeky dude with glasses that you don't know about, you don't even care about, that actually puts all the little bits of sound together that actually makes up what you're hearing. He's the artist, and you never hear about him. The rest of it is just a face that they have to put on the front of it because you got to be able to relate to something. Nobody wants to see that dude in glasses sitting behind the computer. That's just lame, man. But that's how the music literally actually gets done now.
Well, you have glasses, Ace.
I know, I do. And nobody wants to see me on an album cover as a result. But the point being is that the true artists are now dudes behind a computer, and that's just not as sexy as the guy on stage with a guitar. But the reality is the dude on the computer is the one that's actually making the music. And in the case, he's not even making music in a lot of cases. He's just piecing together little Lego blocks of sound.
Right.
And
Well, I think we're talking, too, about, you know, there's a lot of things, the plugins, for instance, on... Mm-hmm. With digital now, they have all these plugins which are, you know, you can plug in for everything, EQ, compression, and
even analog tape sound.
Slate is this new software that will inflate sound instead of compress it, which kind of defeats the purpose of getting away from analog in the first place, but it has all those digital shortcuts, so
But there are things that allow, like Ace was saying, people who aren't really musicians to be out there making music. And there are people that aren't, you know, there's, for instance, the plug-in, the auto-tune plug-in.
There
are supposedly a lot of singers out there that would have never made it had they not had the auto-tuner. Because they never had that singing ability to sing in tune.
Auto-tune drives me crazy, man. I can hear it on a whole lot of popular music and stuff. It sounds like this effect and stuff. It sounds like a robot.
Some of that's intentional, I think, for an effect.
But some of it, they think they're making it sound better, but I can hear it. It sounds like a chorus or some weird effect and stuff. I wonder what Taylor Swift actually sounds like, because all the records sound like a robot singing.
A few months ago, Scott Newbert, who used to play with Hal Ketchum, Keith played with him years ago in Hal Ketchum's band.
Yeah.
I saw Scott's post, and he said he was in the Nashville airport, and he heard Rascal Flatts commercial, and they were just speaking, and their speaking voice had auto-tune on it. Or it sounded like it, you know. I can't remember exactly what the post was, but
it was... Well, there's a sound to it that you learn to recognize, man, and it drives me nuts.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. It's very funny.
We're going to go ahead and do a little bit of a station identification here, but Ace has a gig with his band tonight at the Green Grove. Ace, you want to tell us about your gig tonight?
I'm playing at the Green Grove in Green tonight with my band, The Homebodies. We play from 6 to 9 tonight, my 7-piece blues band, 3 guitars, bass drums, and the fabulous Home Babes, Joel Merlot and Tracy Chardonnay. And it's good old-fashioned, big three guitar blues band music. If you like the Allman Brothers and Eric Clapton, we do that kind of music.
So
come out and see us tonight. And Rick, man, it's great hearing from you, man. I miss you, dude.
Yeah, we do miss you, Rick.
Yeah, I wish I could be there, man.
Yeah. Anyway, y'all take it easy. I'm going to go play some music in the real world.
Thanks, Ace.
Thanks, Ace. Good talking to you.
And we are back, Philosophy and Popular Music. This has been episode 4, and I gave the episode the name The Aesthetics and Technology of Digital versus Analog, or Analog versus Digital, rather. And I've been talking with my good friends, Ace Pepper. Ace just had to leave to go to his gig down in New Braunfels. So if you want to go see the Homebodies, Ace, Grant Mazak, Bruce Weldy, Mike Taylor, what is Mel's last name? I'm blanking on that. Mel Nolte, yes. And Jill Hulchek and Tracy Mock, my good friends, the Homebodies. They're playing from 6 to 9 down at Green Grove, so go and see them. I may head down there myself. But I've still got Rick Stockton, our San Martian from many years ago, who's now living with his wife Helen in Colorado, and we sure do miss them, and it's great to talk to you, Rick. Rick, I was just thinking of a couple of sort of, I guess they're not tangents so much, but they're related to this topic of digital versus analog that Ace mentioned. Before he left, he was talking about how, you know, the digital world has kind of enabled people who, you know, weren't very good singers to be able to use auto-tune and things, tricks like that, to be able to come off as pro sounding. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of something else that was, it reminded me of something, another kind of a tangent of sorts. I was listening to, this was years ago, I'd gotten some association record, and it was a song of Jules's that I hadn't heard before, because I really only had up to that point like their greatest hits album, and so I was kind of learning more of their songs. And it was a song of Jules's called Goodbye Forever, which I actually ended up recording and putting on Keith Carper's tribute album. But I was listening to that song. It was a CD copy of you know, so it was a more compressed version of the original, you know, vinyl song from back in 69. And I was listening and I heard this weird noise, and I'd have to ask Jules how they recorded this particular song, but there was probably several of them around maybe one or two mics. I think that's generally how they did it. But I heard a voice say the word "careful," like somebody, you know, somebody in the studio while the song was rolling. It was like, "Careful, like don't knock over that boom," you know, whatever. It was just somebody cautioning somebody else, and it was obviously a case of this audio was not picked up on the analog version. So the compression brought that audio exterior, you know, that noise, which was not supposed to be on the song, upped, because it was a digital version. So that was kind of a that's something that I've noticed that compression can do, is it'll bring up all the noise. So stuff that you don't want to hear sometimes will come up.
I've heard that, and particularly you know, sometimes, you know, like I remember when CDs first came out.
Yeah.
You know, I would listen to, like, for instance, the Beatles CDs when they first came out, and
sure,
you're used to hearing them on discs, on you know,
right,
LPs,
right,
or whatever, and they just did not sound the same. It was like it lost some of the magic, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've come a long ways since the very early days, and they figured out how to get them to sound better. The CDs sound pretty good, really good now, actually. But that was one thing, you know, I noticed at first. And so, you know, sometimes I think when they make these copies, it's just some guy in there just running off the copy, and they're not paying that much attention to the details on it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, they're not giving heed to those nuances that even a digital artifact should you know, strive for, you know. So but also, you know, there's that old, this is the other kind of tangential point, but you know, I know groups from the 60s, like the Beatles, like the Association, like, you know, any of those vocal pop or rock bands, they typically had a show business ethic, which is to say they honed their craft. They did their job like a 40-hour week, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and they worked at it. And that's another thing that I thought when Ace was bringing that up, I was like, ah, that's kind of not directly related to what we're talking about. But no, I think it is, because the digital technology enables, it enables the illusion of performance, I guess, is perhaps what I'm trying to say here. You know, it can it's not necessarily musical. It can mask or it can cover up what otherwise would have been just, you know, pure chops or pure talent or whatever. So
right. Well, I mean, you know, it's with multi-track, you know, that's first thing that happened is you know, people would put down the basic tracks, and then, you know, some other musicians would come in, and they may not even see or know the guys that put down the original tracks.
Sure.
And they would lay a track down. But now it's getting to the point where you can, with digital, you can record in one city and send it off to another place through the internet.
Sure.
And have somebody lay the track
Dropbox,
down. And I've done that
exactly
with people who've sent me tracks and needed a guitar track, and I'll just throw the guitar track. But this is happening all over the place. There's a bunch of guys like in Nashville,
mm-hmm,
that'll, like, say, put rhythm tracks down. All you have to do is just send them some tracks, and they'll put the drums on it.
Yeah.
You know, a really great drummer, and you can get these famous people, or actually, you know, kind of famous studio guys to be on your records, you know.
Yeah.
And it's reasonably, you know, it's probably pretty economical to do it.
Yeah.
Because these guys are quick and they do it quickly. And but, you know, you lose that camaraderie ship,
exactly,
of a group playing together,
yeah,
in the same room.
Yeah.
And I think there's something about the sound mixing on all the mics. You get a little bit of the drums on this, on the guitar mic, and, you know, there's just, that's one thing you lose, you know. Everything is so pristine.
Yeah.
And and that's, you know, I know that's happening all the time now. And you've, right, in fact, you know, you see these things on YouTube where they have people singing the same song, and they're all over the world, you know.
Right.
You've seen those, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. But
yeah,
that's what digital has brought us, and the internet, you know, and we can do that now.
Yeah.
But there's something about it, it's not quite, you know, you don't have that group together that's playing, you know, and there's something that happens when you have that interchange of ideas.
Absolutely.
That,
yeah,
that it's, you know, those type of situations where one producer has an idea and he's telling everybody what to do, and but that's his project. But, you know, when you get a bunch of people in the same room playing, somebody will say, well, let's do it this way, or let's try this here, and then,
right,
you know, sometimes you come out with a better product, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's, it's yeah, the technology has created situations of convenience, you know. And somebody might say, I don't want to drive an hour to, I'll just mail you the tracks, and you can do that, and that might be great in one sense, but it's also, it's not the same spirit, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah, you lose a little bit of that spirit, you know, and also you lose some of the creative ideas that might have come,
absolutely,
from having a bunch of people that are really good musicians playing together.
Synergy.
And, yeah.
Well, I'm gonna have Steve, my producer, play one more song, but perhaps you could, if you can recall what we were talking on the break about digital tricks that you did with this song called, it's a Monkey song called "Love Is Only Sleeping." What do you remember? How this was pulled off?
Yeah, this is, of course, this was an analog trick. This,
right,
is some things that's really hard to do digitally, and there are some things, you know. Digital has brought us so many things we can do that, you know, are impossible to do with analog, but there were some things you could do analog that were really difficult to do on digital.
Mm-hmm.
And like on the 24-track 2-inch machine I have, it has something called VeriSpeed,
uh-huh,
which you can slow it down a little bit or speed it up a little bit or slow it down a lot, slow down the tape, and therefore the the note changes as you turn it down.
Oh, wow. Pitch shift, yeah, okay.
It shifts, pitch shift, yeah. And so if you can do that with instruments and get a whole different sound. Of course, Les Paul was doing that in the 50s when he was recording, and he sort of revolutionized that, but he wasn't using VeriSpeed. He was just doubling it because they didn't have VeriSpeed back then. Yeah. But later on, they came up with this VeriSpeed thing. And we used that quite a bit. And the Beatles and, you know, a lot of people back in the 60s were using that, and to just get a little different timbre on the instruments. And but on this song, we're talking about the Monkey song that we recorded, Love Is Only Sleeping. There is a instrumental in the middle. Okay. And what you will hear on that is a backwards guitar.
Ah.
And that is done, the way you do that analog is you just flip the tape upside down and you play a part, and the music will be playing backwards, and you play over the backwards music on the guitar, and it sounds really cool. And you'll hear that on a lot of songs from, you know, the Beatles, and Jimi Hendrix did it, and just all sorts of people were doing it back when in the analog days, but you hardly ever hear it anymore now that we've gone digital.
And so
you'll hear that on this next song that you're planning on playing. And there's a couple of spots where we used those little funky mics you get with cheap cassette recorders and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's just these little crappy little mics, but we used that on one little part on the on this next song too, just to get a really crappy vocal sound. And you might hear that. It's this little repeating vocal, you'll hear it on that, and that's another kind of analog-y thing we did.
Okay.
And
send us to the end of the hour. So, Rick, thank you so much for your time, and it was so great to have you on the show. We're going to do an encore performance of my show last week after this is over. And
great.
How about I'm going to give you a call on your cell after we get situated here about later today. But I really appreciate you taking the time, Rick. Thanks so much.
Well, my pleasure, and congratulations on your radio show. It's
thanks,
good,
man.
To see you guys are carrying the torch in San Marcos.
Absolutely.
You know, we try to get back there periodically, but it's like it's been over two years now. I miss it. But we'll get down there, and I can't wait to see you guys in person soon.
Thanks, Rick.